Hi, welcome to WeLectures. We are doing banking fundamentals and we are on chapter 5. In the last four chapters, we have seen how banking evolved. In the first chapter, we saw the world banking evolution. In the second chapter, we saw how banking evolved in India. After evolution of banking in India, we saw there was a requirement of regulations. Hence, the Banking Regulation Act 1949 was enacted. After Banking Regulation 1949, we saw an important nationalization of the Reserve Bank of India, which acted as a central bank of our country. Central bank plays a very important role in our banking functioning, as well as various other arms of the finance activities. I would like to refer to page number 57 of your banking fundamentals, in which there is a beautiful classification of the Indian banking system. It starts with RBI as the central bank, which is further classified into commercial banks, development banks, and apex banks. Your commercial banks are further classified into public sector banks, foreign banks, private sector banks, and cooperative banks. This entire thing is included in your chapter 5. Chapter 6 covers the next part, which is the development banks, in which we are going to cover the Industrial Finance Corporation of India, the IRBI, and the SIDBI. What are apex bodies? This forms the third important arm of the RBI classification. The apex bodies comprises of Exim Bank, the NABARD, and the National Housing Bank. So let's start with Chapter 5, which is commercial banks. In this chapter, you are going to understand the manner in which Indian commercial banking system is grouped, which is the public sector banks, the foreign banks, the private banks, and the cooperative banks. But before we discuss or enter into the chapter of a commercial bank, let's understand what is a commercial bank. I would like you to go to the post-nationalization period, wherein only one word for a bank was uttered, and that is the commercial bank. Commercial bank was mainly doing the wholesale banking. What is wholesale banking? It was only servicing the large corporates. The individuals were not looked into. That's the reason the nationalization of bank happened, and we started calling the public sector banks, because a majority of stake was of the government. Over the period, there was a big boom of consumerism in the 1990s, and that's where banks started focusing on the retail customer. And that's where we started differentiating between commercial banking and the retail banking. Commercial banking was targeted on the large customers, basically the corporates, the large corporates, whereas retail banking was focused more on the individuals and the small business entities. That is the stage when retail banking started booming all across the country. And that's where we started giving importance to consumer banking. Now we have a clear distinction between commercial banking and retail banking. But in a larger aspect, a commercial bank provides services such as accepting deposits, giving business loans, and basic investment products to individual members of the public as well as to the corporates. So we see commercial banking includes banking both to the individuals as well as to the corporates or large business also. In the US, the commercial bank was often used to distinguish from an investment bank. After the Great Depression, the US Congress required that commercial bank only engage in banking activities, whereas investment banks were invited to the capital markets. So a clear distinction was set between an investment bank and a commercial bank in the US, so that there will be no mixing up of business activity. Each one was clear about what to do. Commercial bank can be categorized in India broadly into two categories, the scheduled bank and the non-scheduled bank. Mind you, this definition has come from our Banking Regulation Act 1949. It is clearly specified in the section what is a scheduled bank and what is a non-scheduled bank. Let's see what the definition says. Section 2 subclause E of the Reserve Bank of India Act defines a scheduled bank as a bank included in the second schedule. What do you mean by a bank included in the second schedule? Can every bank and any bank be included in the second schedule of RBI Act? No. Let's see what are the conditions that are required for inclusion in the second schedule of the RBI Act. These conditions are mentioned in section 42, subclause 6, subclause A of the RBI Act. RBI includes only those banks in the scheduled category of RBI Act which satisfy the criteria laid down by section 42, subclause 6, subclause A of the RBI Act 1934. Let's see what for section 42 subclause 6 subclause A says. Requirements under section 42 subclause 6 subclause A of the RBI Act 1934 says the bank should carry on the business of banking in India, and number one condition is which has a paid up capital and reserves of an aggregate value of not less than 5 lakhs of rupees, and most important criteria is its affairs are not being conducted in a manner detrimental to the interest of its depositors. So the entire focus is on the interest of the depositors. The moment RBI finds it defeats the purpose that there is no focus on the customer, there can be a serious issue and it can account to cancellation of a license. The third important condition is it must be a state cooperative bank or a company as defined in Companies Act 1956 or an institution notified by the central government in this behalf, or a corporation or a company incorporated by or under any law in force in any place outside of India. So after understanding the requirements for inclusion of any banking company in the second schedule of RBI Act 1934, let's move on to the features of a scheduled bank. Scheduled banks are required to maintain a cash reserve with RBI, and this reserve can be varied or changed by RBI to maintain the liquidity in our financial markets. Currently, this rate is 4% of your demand and time liability. Remember, we have seen the definition of a demand and time liability in our Banking Regulation Act 1949. RBI may raise or lower this, and this raising or lowering of cash reserve is announced in your monetary policy of Reserve Bank of India. Monetary policy, as we have seen, it comes in quarterly interval and even in mid-quarterly interval. So based on RBI's understanding of the economy, of the inflation, of the market, RBI decides whether more money from the bank should be pulled in the form of a cash reserve. Scheduled commercial banks, including foreign banks, are required to extend a certain minimum portion of their lending credit to the priority sector. We have seen this limit of priority sector is 40% of your total lending portfolio. Scheduled banks enjoy certain privileges that include financial assistance from Reserve Bank of India under Section 17 of the RBI Act 1934. Just as a bank gives loans to the customer, same way bank sometime requires some lender. And we have seen this in our RBI chapter. RBI acts as a banker to bank, and this is where a bank borrows from the Reserve Bank of India. This borrowing can happen only and only if the bank is a scheduled bank, which means it is listed in the second schedule of the Reserve Bank of India Act 1934. Then what is a non-scheduled bank? It's simple. Once you understand what is a scheduled bank, non-scheduled bank in India are those that conduct banking business which are not listed in the second schedule of the RBI Act 1934. They do not comply to the minimum requirement of those Section 46, and hence they don't enjoy any of the privileges of scheduled bank. As simple as that. Let's see some history of non-scheduled banks. At the outbreak of World War I, there were over 1400 non-scheduled banks in operation in India. The enactment of Banking Regulation Act 1949 led to the reduction of all these numbers. A weeding out was required of all those banks which were not complying with the requirements of Banking Regulation Act 1949. In September 1960, Section 45 was introduced, which empowered Reserve Bank of India to compulsory amalgamate the weak units with the strong ones. And as a result of that, as on March 31st, 2006, there were only 4 non-scheduled banks. All of these were the local area banks. Having seen that, let us see the categorization of the scheduled commercial banks. Scheduled commercial banks in India are categorized into different groups according to, please note this, they are categorized into different groups according to the ownership pattern, the nature of their operations, and this categorization can be seen as follows. The number one category comes in the form of public sector banks. Now, public sector banks includes your State Bank of India, the associate banks of State Bank of India, as well as the nationalized banks and the regional rural banks. The second category comes in the form of private sector banks. The third category in the form of cooperative banks. And the fourth category in the form of foreign banks. What is IDBI Bank? Is it a scheduled bank? Yes, of course. But why is it not included in any of these 4 categories? For a simple reason, it is called a financial intermediary in the form of other public sector Indian banks. It has special status as an financial intermediary, other public sector Indian banks. We are going to see each one of them in our next slides with examples. Let's come up with the first group. Before we go that, let us see some statistics. As of 31st of March 2010, there were 165 scheduled banks in India, having a total network of 83,635. This was on March 2010. Currently, we have already surpassed the 1 lakh figure for the branches all over the country. In addition to the branches, most of the banks have used ATMs as a very strong customer acquisition tool. The technology in the form of ATM not only helped the banks to reduce the transaction cost, the biggest advantage to the customer was in the form of doing anytime banking as well as anywhere banking, 24/7, even on a holiday. Unfortunately, having a large space in our country, the large land area expanse, our ATMs are still lesser compared to the penetration level of other countries. As of 2011, our ATM penetration was only 8.90, whereas it was highest in Australia, 166. You can see a brief comparison of the ATMs on-site as well as the off-site as of May 2013. That is the latest figures. But one thing we have to notice, ATMs have taken away lots of transactional work of the branches, and the branch staff is having more time for the customers. Let's see what is the ATM advantage. ATMs are helping banks facilitate banking outreach in the remote areas. Like in ATMs also, we have different models of ATMs. In the cities, we see full-fledged model, whereas in remote areas, we have a smaller module which can be only cash dispenser or doing some balance inquiry. So based on the requirements, the ATM models can be installed at various parts of our country. The cost to the bank of a customer walking into a branch is about 10 times of our ATM transaction. So which means our ATM transaction cost is 1/10 of a cost that is incurred in a branch. So obviously a transaction on ATM has to be encouraged. There are various models for setting up of ATMs. ATM installation is a costly business. Initially, every bank wanted to have ATMs. Some banks which cannot afford ATMs, they entered into an arrangement with the banks already having ATMs. That was called ATM sharing arrangement. Now the latest word is the white label ATMs. What are the white label ATMs? White label ATMs simply means the bank is following an OPEX model. The Tatas have already installed these white label ATMs in our Mumbai. We see a lot of white label ATMs installed by Tatas at various places. But what are these white label ATMs or the OPEX model ATMs? In an OPEX model, a third party like a Tata, which is not a bank, installs and manages the ATM, which is shared by several banks, and the third party gets paid for each transaction. So he installs the ATM in a very crowded area so that the transactions are absorbed by such ATMs, and the third party benefits for every transaction that is done or performed on such white label ATMs. Some of the banks won't agree with this OPEX model because that is the main place where they can market and show their branding. So they would like to invest in the ATMs, and hence banks planning to invest in infrastructure could set up its own ATMs, and that model, if we call it as the CapEx heavy model. So currently ATMs can be installed on the basis of the OPEX model as well as your CapEx model. What is the ATM future? At present, there are over 1,18,000 ATMs in the country. Public sector banks account for 60% of the total number of ATMs in our country. India is expected to be one of the biggest markets of ATMs installation by 2016 with more than 2,25,000 ATMs. And once the new generation private sector banks are given licenses, and once they go into the non-banked, unbanked rural areas, we can see lots more of ATMs installation happening in such areas where people were not aware even of simple banking. Nearly half the ATMs are expected to be outsourced. Outsourced means the OPEX model, the white label format, as it would help banks to achieve a cost efficiency. Banks are concerned with removing the or moving the transaction from the branch to an automated terminal. It is not necessary that they go for installations. The larger banks can afford because it gives them an additional channel of marketing. Now let's see the first classification of the total scheduled banks, which is the public sector banks. Which are public sector banks? These banks are having government ownership. So public sector banks are those banks in which the government either owns or has a majority stake in it. This came into being to a wave of nationalization. What is nationalization? We have seen this in our second chapter, Evolution of Indian Banking. The private sector banks were taken over by government, and the social control or the social activities in banking were initiated for the benefit of the larger masses. The first nationalization happened, which many very few people know it, because they generally say nationalization only of those public sector banks happening in two phases, the first one in 1969 and the second one in 1980. But friends, before 1969 and 1980, the first nationalization happened in the year 1949. Please note this, very few people know this. And this nationalization happened when Imperial Bank of India was nationalized. In 1955, it became the State Bank of India. Sorry, I would like to note the first nationalization came in the form of Reserve Bank of India in 1949, after which Imperial Bank of India was nationalized in 1955 and became the State Bank of India. Later, its seven associate subsidiaries were also nationalized in 1960. The majority of the shares of the State Bank of India are held by RBI itself, a nationalized institution. So what do we understand over here? The first nationalization, Reserve Bank of India in the year 1949. The second came in the form of Imperial Bank of India having government ownership and the name change in the form of State Bank of India in the year 1955. Then in the year 1960, all the associates and subsidiaries were nationalized and formed as associates and subsidiaries of State Bank of India. After 1960, two important things happened. Let's see what. Before we see that, let's complete this slide. Public sector banks, in addition, are governed by the statutes under which they are incorporated. Like we have seen State Bank of India in the previous slide, let's complete the statute which regulates and governs the State Bank of India. The State Bank of India, under the State Bank of India Act 1955 and the associate banks of the State Bank of India under the State Bank of India Subsidiary Banks Act 1959. So these are the two main regulations which regulates the State Bank of India and its subsidiaries. The nationalized banks under the Banking Companies Acquisition and Transfer of Undertakings Act 1970 and 1980, which were mainly applicable to your other public sector banks. The basic purpose of nationalization of State Bank of India was establish a strong, integrated and state partnership commercial banking institutions with an effective machinery of branches all over the country that would stimulate banking development by providing vastly extended remittance facilities for the cooperative and other banks, and by following a consonant with the national policies adopted by the government without departing from the principle of sound business. A very long purpose indeed. But let us break up and see what does it mean. Let us consider the days when Imperial Bank of India, remember the presidency banks, the three presidency banks were actually converted into Imperial Bank of India. And for whom they were acting for? They were simply acting for the British government. They were not interested in serving the masses of our country. The individuals and the poor farmers were totally ignored, and because of which our economy was not growing. Only the banking transactions were happening for the administration of the East India Company. And hence, the State Bank of India was established for taking banking to the remote areas of our country, to every nook and corner of the country. And that is why we say, as per the national policies, our national policy requires every small farmer, every poor person should be a part of our economy. And how can they be a part of our economy? Only when they understand what is banking, only when they inculcate an habit of banking, only when they bring in their savings in the bank. And that's how you can also get some sort of loans for your productive purpose. So that was the basic purpose of nationalization of State Bank of India, and that's the reason we see as of today State Bank of India is the largest bank of our country, and it is having branches across the country, in every nook and corner of the country, in every state of our country. Other public sector banks, but in spite of the mass existence of State Bank of India, the banking was not reaching the interiors. It had a lesser penetration power due to the huge population of our country. And hence, government thought of nationalizing other private sector banks so that more banks will be focused on the banking activities for the larger base of our unbanked areas. So public sector banks came into being as a result of two waves on nationalization. The first wave came in the year 1969, wherein the 14 banks that had a deposit base of over 50 crores were nationalized by the government. The second phase came in the form of nationalization of 6 banks, which had a deposit base of over 200 crores, and the dates for 69 were July 19, 1969. The dates for 1980 were April 15, 1980. With the nationalization of 14 banks in 1969 and 6 banks in 1980, 95% of the banking business was under the government control. Only 5% was with the private sector, and hence government could implement its policy, the national policy, for the benefit of larger masses, benefits reaching the poorest poor of our country in the form of banking facility of both accepting deposits as well as lending to the needy for the productive purpose, as well as doing other banking activities like remittances, etc. In 1993, Government of India could not bear the financial condition of one of the nationalized bank, which is New Bank of India, and hence it was merged with Punjab National Bank in the year 1993, and that makes a tally of the other public sector banks as on today as 14 plus 6, which is 20, minus 1 in the form of New Bank of India, and hence the total other public sector banks in our country are 19 as of today. What was the basic purpose of nationalization of other banks? This was basically done to take banking to the villages and serve the development needs of all the sectors of the economy. The government wanted a socialistic pattern. Socialistic pattern means a society has to grow, not a capitalist economy, a socialistic pattern in which the society is growing, and it was hoped that the nationalization would effectively decentralize the credit. It will relieve the pressure of the moneylenders on the larger masses in the rural base. Within the result, that priority sector advances would be encouraged, such as agriculture, small-scale industries, now we call it as MSME, micro and small and medium scale industries, the export sector, the self-employed sector, so that in an era of large unemployment, people will have self-employment, not only gaining a livelihood for themselves, but contribution to the economy as well. And that banking units would be extended to the rural area, India being an agrarian economy, larger part of the people live in the rural areas, and if the banking reaches the rural areas, the people will grow, the productive activities will grow, and that's how the economy will grow. This is a list of all the scheduled banks in India, which includes your State Bank of India, as well as the associate banks, as well as the other public sector banks. It starts with State Bank of India, followed by its subsidiaries and the 19 nationalized public sector banks. We have it on the next slide, which completes the total tally of State Bank of India, the subsidiary banks, as well as the other public sector banks. So this is in the third slide also. Now, after completing or understanding what a public sector bank is, let's see what are the private sector banks. private sector banks can be classified into two categories. There is a confusion over here as to differentiating between an ICICI bank and a South Indian bank. Both are private sector bank. But what is the difference? Yes, there is a difference. Let's understand what is the difference. Private sector banks can be categorized into two types, the old private sector banks and the new generation private sector banks. The old private sector banks are existing since our independence. Only those banks which were nationalized from the private sector to the government ownership were called the public sector banks. But we had some more private sector banks existing in our country, and those continue to exist even now. And these are called the old private sector banks. Lakshmi Vilas Bank, the City Union Bank, the Karur Vaishya Bank, the Dhanlakshmi Bank, and the latest one in the news, the South Indian Bank, which received lots of accolades in the form of awards for doing excellent banking. They are all included in the old private sector bank. What are new generation banks? New generation banks came into existence in the early 90s when government opened up our economy because of globalization and liberalization. Lots of financial sector reforms were introduced in the year 1991, and that's where private sector banks were given licenses to open up new banks in our country, and the first of which got a license in that era was the Global Trust Bank. Unfortunately, Global Trust Bank was running into rough weathers, and it got absorbed by Oriental Bank of Commerce recently. But the surviving new generation private sector banks are the Axis Bank, previously it was the UTI Bank, ICICI Bank. Again, we will see ICICI Bank. There was a reverse merger of ICICI, the financial institution, with a bank, ICICI Bank, and hence ICICI, a development financial institution, was reversely merged into ICICI Bank, a new generation private sector bank. Then we have the HDFC Bank and some more. And if you want to see the exact update, the recent additions to this category are your Kotak Mahindra Bank and the Yes Bank, both doing aggressive marketing and giving a tough competition to the new generation banks as well as to your public sector banks as well as to the State Bank of India group. Private sector banks are not owned by the government. That is a very important difference between a public sector bank and a private sector bank. Private sector banks are not owned or controlled by the government. Their shares are freely traded on the stock markets, on the stock exchanges, and are largely owned by general public. The new private sector banks have been aggressive in the business expansion and are highly competitive. Business is the only goal for them. They do their business for profits, and for profits, they will have all sorts of technology, strategies, policies implemented for achieving their targets. More of this we will see when we go to in detail of what are the activities and what is the impact of new generation banks on the public sector. The major breakthrough took place in banking as they started using technology as driver for growth. This technology had a bigger role. I myself have seen introduction of this technology. We were the guinea pigs during that introduction of technology because we had to import various platforms to suit our requirements. But unfortunately, what was happening was that technology was basically done on a COBOL platform, One small script change needs to require a major change in the coding of the entire structure of the software. Slowly, slowly, our Indian IT entrepreneurs started introducing softwares suiting our Indian requirements, because Indian banking is quite different than your European or American banking. The platforms are also differently introduced for matching the products and services. And slowly, our IT companies have gained the expertise, and one of them, Infosys, is now exporting our software to the global markets, suiting their markets also. So we are not only the gainers because of this for getting a good technology suiting our requirements, but our IT companies are also exporting technologies suiting the foreign requirements. So that was a major breakthrough in the introduction of technology as a driver for growth. And because of technology, lots of efficiency was introduced in the operations. The longer queues, as we could see in the public sector banks, because of the manual operations, was cut down by introduction of the technology. All your ledger banking was converted into computer banking. People, or I myself, had taken the ledgers on my laps to do the posting. But now we don't have to do that. Just at a click of a second, we can get the entire history of the customer, whether it is his personal history or whether it's a transactional history. So that's the advantage of technology. We don't have to send letters. One small digital message can reach a customer in any part of the country within seconds. So that is, again, a benefit of communication through technology. So technology has tremendously helped in the growth of Indian banking post entry of new generation private sector banks. Besides providing technology as drivers for growth, services to electronic channels like your ATM, your internet banking, your mobile banking, your kiosk banking, your SMS banking, your home banking, all that has helped cutting costs per transaction. It's not only cutting costs per transaction, but it has given a larger comfort, a larger convenience to the customer. The customer need not come to the branch, need not spend his time for coming to the branch. He can do his banking from wherever he is, from his house or from his office. So that additional comfort, that additional convenience has indeed popularized banking not only in the urban areas, but in the semi-urban and rural areas as well. We can see lots of farmers using the Kisan credit cards, using the ATM cards for doing their transactions. Gone are the days when people used to store money in their houses. Now the money is coming to the banking channel, and that's how it is used as and when required, rather than lying idle in the houses. So that's the advantage of technology for the larger masses. The main features of new private banks. The new banks are expected to adopt a tech-heavy model requiring minimum human capital and the software majors. When we are talking about the new private banks, this we are talking about the new private sector banks who are going to get a license in January 2014. RBI has received lots of applications, about 26, and RBI is in the process of appraising or looking out for those banks or entities who can be allotted a license to start a new generation private sector bank. But what are they going to do? These banks are expected to adopt a more tech-heavy model requiring minimum human capital, software majors. The new bank would still have an advantage over both the state-run as well as the existing private sector banks, as there will be a fewer legacy issues. They can straight away take the latest technology model and drive on it, whereas any change that is required for a new generation private sector bank or a private sector bank or a public sector bank will take some time for introducing the change, running the pilot, and then finally the rollout. So this would be a tremendous advantage starting right from the day one for this new generation private sector bank. They don't have legacy issues. The new banks will push for greater consumer engagement and use of technology to drive the efficiency right from day one. These are the examples of old private sector banks: the Federal Bank, the Dhanlakshmi Bank, the Catholic Syrian Bank, the Lakshmi Vilas Bank, the City Union Bank, the Karur Vysya Bank, and the latest, lots of accolade one bank, the South Indian Bank. Example of the new generation private sector banks: we are Axis Bank, formerly UTI Bank, IndusInd Bank, ICICI Bank, HDFC Bank, IDBI Bank, Kotak Mahindra Bank, and the Yes Bank. As I had referred, there were new guidelines issued for new generation private sector banks. Those who are interested to get licenses for doing private banking were issued in December 2012. We are in now September 2013. Dr. Subba Rao, the then governor, had issued these guidelines. The history goes like this. The Union Finance Minister had made an announcement in his budget speech of 2010-11 that the RBI was considering giving some additional banking licenses to the private sector players. Non-banking finance companies could also be considered if they meet the Reserve Bank of India's eligibility criteria. This was a major boost for the non-banking entities to get converted into a full-fledged bank and get all those additional benefits the scheduled banks or the private sector banks or the public sector banks get from a central bank and the government of India. The new guidelines were termed as licensing of new banks in the private sector, and which were framed, please note this is very important. Initially, when we came up with the licensing guidelines for the new generation banks in the year 1991, we had to look around the world how a private sector bank is functioning. There was no prior experience for us in the private sector banking. But now, the licensing of new banks in the private sector issued in December 2012 were issued based on the experience gained from the functioning of the banks licensed under 1993-2001, and RBI also put up a discussion paper on its website inviting suggestions from all the experts. So this was also an add-on, and that's what we say: feedback and suggestion received in response to the discussion paper put up by RBI on its website, and finally it was released in December 2012. So it has a beautiful structure of what a new generation bank should be, what is the requirement of such bank, in spite of we are having a larger number of your state bank group, your public sector group, your old private sector, as well as your new private sector. So in spite of that, there is a requirement, because the penetration level of banking to the larger masses is still inadequate, and they need to come into the main line of our economy, and hence this requirement was, and hence one of the requirements of this new generation private sector banks is very interesting. We have it in the next slide. RBI to issue more licenses. In response to this December 2012 guidelines, on July 1, 2013, RBI received 26 applications for new bank licenses. The aim of these new bank licenses was financial inclusion. What is financial inclusion? We have studied this in our second chapter. Financial inclusion simply means directing your banking funds towards the weaker sections of the society so that they can come in the mainstream. So the larger focus of issuing this new banking license is financial inclusion. According to RBI guidelines, it is mandatory for all these new sector banks, new private sector banks, to open 25% of branches in the rural areas. No excuses. right from the day one, they had to open 25% of branches in the rural areas, otherwise RBI won't give them the license to open a branch even in an urban area. So that ratio has to be maintained. In addition to that, right from the day one, they have to mandatory follow the cash reserves, which is in the form of CRR, as well as the statutory liquidity ratio, which is in the form of SLR. This means whatever funds they receive, they cannot use the entire funds for lending. A liquidity has to be maintained. A portion of these funds need to be reserved for meeting any eventuality, for meeting any liquidity crisis. So even though they are a new bank, even though the funds will be coming in slow bids, that is one of the main condition for getting a license. So 25% branches in the rural areas, maintenance of CRR and SLR right from the day one, and you also have to do the priority sector lending of 40% of the total lending you are going to do. So which means the financial inclusion is going to be actually implemented if these conditions are followed, and only if these banks are accepting these conditions, then only RBI is going to give them a license. And please note, this is right from the inception, so no moratorium, no waiting period for them. The successful applicant will be those with a super financial firepower and strong management to handle the transition and growth. So only those with strong firepower, with strong money power, with strong management structure will be committing for such conditions and will be getting license from the RBI under this new licensing policy.